Newsmakers. From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, I'm Maureen McCollum. From budget challenges to the start of a controversial new statewide private school voucher plan, the start of a new year in many Wisconsin schools will not be uneventful. Classes for Hamilton Elementary School students already began in July, marking the start of the first year-round school in La Crosse. That's where I started the conversation with La Crosse School Superintendent Randy Nelson regarding some of the changes a new year brings for the district.
What we're hearing is all positive at this particular point, and our parents have been fully on board on this. At the same time, we had some parents that when we moved down this path, we had some parents who said, I don't know that schedule is going to work. We provided them an opportunity in another school for us. But we also gained several new students, certainly their parents as well, because they liked the idea of this year-round calendar. So things are going well. And one of the several reasons that we were discussing doing this was that we really felt that for students that we could help mitigate what we see as the summer slide. That's when students have a full 12 weeks off, we find ourselves at the beginning of the next school year spending a lot of time reteaching, trying to get kids caught up so that we can start working on the grade level curriculum that we're supposed to be in. So this was designed to kind of reduce the number of students that would require reteaching at the beginning of the year. Just based on the discussion I had with Mr. Michaels here last week, what he's telling me is that the data that they're looking at right now is suggesting that indeed that did happen. We have fewer students who are requiring supports here at the beginning of the year, which is exactly what we wanted to do, among several other things as well.
And there are 45 days on and 15 days off?
Yep, it's called a 45-15 calendar. You know, sometimes people get a little confused because they know that, for instance, that the state has a law that says you can't start school before Labor Day, I think, if that's something like that. But there are exceptions to that, and one of the exceptions is if you have a year-round calendar. And there are several ways to look at a year-round calendar, but the Department of Public Instruction views a 45-15 calendar, as such as the one we're doing, as what a year-round calendar means.
What about for students? I mean, the idea that they are not getting the full summer break they're totally used to. Granted, they're younger students. This is K through third grades.
Yep, so that's right. Well, it's K through three. And then what we're anticipating is that we'll add grade four next year and grade five the next year, so that eventually over the next 3 years, this really will be a K-5 option. I think, and based on my own experience, actually, as a parent, I really saw my school-age children, especially at elementary level, they were ready for something in the middle of July. They were ready to go back, spend some more time with friends, not just their neighborhood friends who they're spending time with now, but their other friends as well. From that student perspective, I think it's been fine for them, and they're still getting opportunity in this year-round calendar to play. They're getting opportunity to connect with their friends and stay connected with their friends. And so I do think in many ways it's a win-win for them.
And if it ends up being successful, and however you measure success with a program like this, would there be the possibility of expanding it to other schools within the district over time?
If, as you said, how we move forward in measuring this and the success of this, you know, I think we would be doing ourselves a disservice if we didn't at least look at it. If this is really successful and we intend to be research-based and best practice-based, we really need to spend the time to take a look at that particular program and talk about its efficacy in other buildings in the future. If, on the other hand, we don't see it as successful as what we thought it might be, then just the opposite could be true. Is it something that we should continue or not? So, you know, I think it's going to take us 2 or 3 years, really, to really look at that and determine whether this is something, a practice we should crystallize or not.
I understand that there's care provided for students who, when school's in session at all the other schools, so I'm assuming outside of the summertime, there's care either at the school or you're working with Boys and Girls Club on that. Right. Has that added extra costs within the school district?
No, not really. What's happened is that, you know, during there's 45 days on, there's 15 days off. And so during those 15 days off, we're calling that an intercession. And what we're doing is we're ensuring that even during the intercession, we have activities and opportunities available to those children so they can still come to school. But we're partnering with the Boys and Girls Club, with the Y, and other organizations to ensure that there's good support there and that we're providing good enrichment and perhaps even sometimes some intervention. In terms of cost, the 3 week interventions the 3 week intercessions are not so much a cost factor as some staffing things that we've had to invest in a little bit this year. It's not a huge amount, but we really found ourselves in a position that, well, let's invest in this practice because it's not completely cost neutral. For instance, we have some staff staff who are working on this particular schedule that starts on July 18th, while at the same time they're working on the traditional schedule. And so that causes some challenges in terms of scheduling their days, not scheduling the days, and you know, when they're going to work, and does have a small price tag to it to do that. But it's worth the run at it. What we know is that as in our public schools, we've got to look at our practices. We've got to be willing to do some things differently in order to move forward in support of our children, but also our community and its parents.
Have the teachers had to change maybe the way they prepare for the school year?
Let me use a term for you that is not real scientific, but it comes from curriculum experts. The term is chunking. And what they really talk about is having the capacity when they look at these 4 9-week periods of time is being able to more effectively plan and chunk their curriculum in such a way that they can keep a better perspective on the whole year. It's a challenge when you're in the classroom, and sometimes you'll get into March or April and you'll revisit your curriculum documents and where you are, and in March all of a sudden, oh my goodness, it's March and I'm only halfway through my curriculum. I should have been here in January. I'm gonna have to start picking this up a little bit. Whereas when you get that opportunity, those 3 weeks, those 15 days in intercession, to be able to stop, regroup, take a look at your next 9 weeks, it's a better way to plan and to chunk that curriculum. And I think it provides more success for the children. And it also, I think, provides a better peace of mind for the teaching staff as well. Say, here's our 9 weeks, here's what we're going to do. The other thing that sometimes happens during those intercessions is that teachers have the capacity, as they look at that next 9 weeks and what they're going to be doing, they really have the capacity as a team to sit down and say, maybe we should move some kids around here. Because we're going to be doing this in social studies or this in mathematics, this could make better sense. This is an area that you're stronger in than I am, et cetera. And so I think it plays well in terms of working with one another and being a team.
You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. My guest today is La Crosse School District Superintendent Randy Nelson. We're talking about the new school year. Another change this year is that the Design Institute, which is one of the charter choice schools within the district, has expanded to sixth graders.
This is a school that is going to be adding grade six. It's also one that we will just received a new charter school grant with the idea to extend that experience into high school as well. And so we're looking at that contract with the governance council of that charter school to determine what's going to work here, what's not going to work, and how would we want to move forward with that. Ultimately, what we're looking for, and one of the unique things about this particular charter school, is that this is really based on project-based learning. It's based on the kids, the students actually identifying the problems and projects through an inquiry-based model about, you know, what it is that I'm curious about. But what's, I think, really neat about it is that the students still have to meet all of the standards. They use a little program that we have that has them actually monitor their pace on those standards and how they're doing on all of those standards. So the other unique thing about this is that it is student-based. It's kind of customized. The students are really managing themselves, and the teacher really is facilitator, helping them out and helping them with further questions or maybe resources or ideas about how they can make that their project even better. It's designed to be a program that is embedded in our community, whereas our school is kind of the place where the students meet every day. We're really intending for it to branch out into something in the community. And the last thing I'll say is that charter schools really sometimes tend to be a place where we try new practices. And this new practice of allowing students to really navigate their own learning and to monitor their own learning, to keep track of their own learning, is something that I think is going to be important in the future of public education. Down the road, we really need to make sure that we have the capacity to customize the education of every child. I think that's where things are going, and I think that something like this helps us better understand, even at the early stages, what it's like to do that, what it takes to do that.
Something that started up last year within the La Crosse School District was the La Crosse Promise. It's sort of this two-phase program.
Right.
Where first they want to help high school students prepare for college, and eventually down the line, they want to develop a program that would provide scholarships to students who pledge to stay within the city of La Crosse. Right now, we're just still in the Future Center phase of it. But how did that go for students? What sort of feedback did you get for those who are preparing for college?
Actually, we received really good feedback. You know, what we have in the Future Centers, this is, as you mentioned, a part of the La Crosse Promise. And really, La Crosse Promise is moving forward right now as a significant economic development sort of approach for our city, for our community. But one of the pieces, because is ultimately the goal is to provide a scholarship for all of our graduates, whether it's a scholarship to a four-year college or a two-year college or to go get a welding certificate, makes no difference. But every graduate would have access to dollars to help them with tuition. That's the end goal. But in order for us to really get there, we're really doing some things incrementally. And one of the first things that we're doing is we're really working on these future centers to ensure that the pieces are in place at high school so that if and when that particular scholarship program ever does become a reality, we've got students who are fully prepared to navigate this. Now, one of the things that happens with this is we have a future center advisor in each one of our two high schools. Our private schools are also included in this, and so they're assigned in part to our private schools as well. But these individuals are working with parents, they're working with students. The whole process of getting yourself not just ready for college, but those imminent months right before you do go to college where you're selecting a college and you're getting your financial aid, those things can be pretty daunting to the extent that some parents would say, hey, let's not even go there. This is ridiculous what we have to do to get this done. Or some parents will say from a generational standpoint, I didn't go on after high school, and so, or they'll say, I don't know that we can afford to go on, et cetera. And so part of this, part of the work right now is to help our students demystify this. This is in partnership with our guidance counselors in our schools because they still do this work as well. This is adding more hands on this with, a focus completely for that purpose. They have evening meetings with parents and help parents understand things that need to go on. They help students with essays. If they have to write an essay to be accepted into a school, they'll help them with the content of those essays, how they might organize that, et cetera. So it's a wonderful service, and it's there. It's been funded for 3 years by private dollars, by individuals in our community who believe that this is a good idea. And so it's funded for 3 years. This coming school year, we're starting our second year. And from the first year data that we're receiving, we've had hundreds of students who have been positively impacted by the Future Centers. We want to expand the number of students, of course, because I think as we move down this path, as we get to that point where all of our students would have access to a scholarship if they choose to use it, the Future Centers will be an important component of that.
You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. My guest today is Randy Nelson. He's the superintendent of the School District of La Crosse. Another big change this year is the fact that Aquinas Catholic Schools was one of 25 schools in the state that was approved to offer vouchers within the area. Yeah. I'm wondering if you can talk about what this means for the School District of La Crosse.
Yeah. You know, if I could, Maureen, first in the bigger sense here, I think that for those of us who kind of watch what happens politically and with our legislature, I don't think in decades, perhaps in the history of our state, has there been more landmark things that have been passed through our legislature here than this last budget session. And perhaps the voucher piece stands at the top of that list of very unique things that are happening. That being said, our school district has a strong relationship with our Aquinas schools. We provide for them much of their transportation. We're required to by law. We do provide for them consultative services and special education as we're required to by law. So we have a good working relationship with our Catholic schools, and actually they do a nice job of educating kids. They're a good option that's out there, no doubt about that. I think that one of the challenges that we've had with the way the vouchers have come forward in terms of providing that choice is that there has not been, there has not been an important conversation about accountability. I just believe that where there is public dollars, there ought to be public accountability for those dollars. And I think it's really important, and I hope that as this piece moves forward, assuming that it will, that there's more discussion about that and other accountability measures as well.
And I believe there is pending legislation regarding
Yeah, and what I'm concerned about is that even as I'm looking at that pending legislation, it looks like it's really limited to just being on the state's report card. So all of our schools will be receiving a report card with a score out of 100 on that report card, and it looks like the private voucher schools will be on that as well. So there's an accountability piece for academics. But there are so many other accountability pieces that are in place for public schools that really, by virtue of the rules that were passed, don't have to be there for our private voucher schools. And I think that remains a concern as we move forward. As you may know, there are several restrictions that in these first 2 years have been put in place by the legislature with regard to the number of students who could actually go into a private voucher school. No more than 1% of our public school students in the school district of La Crosse can go into that. No more than 500 students statewide, and then 1,000 students the next year can go into that. But I think one of the things that we all have to just assume, whether we like it or not, is that those numbers are going to change during the next funding biennium. I really think that our legislators are going to say, let's just do it for everyone. It doesn't matter what your income is. It doesn't matter how many students, et cetera. You know, the goal here is a voucher in every student's backpack. The goal here is to do a degree of privatizing and provide those opportunities for parents to make those decisions. And so I think we have to be prepared for that. And whereas that hasn't been the case as much in the past, we need to be prepared for that.
And you've said in the past that financially, depending on where all this goes, it could have an impact on the school district of La Crosse.
Well, definitely. And really what's happened now is that it already is having an impact in terms of budgetary work. Our legislature set aside millions of dollars last year for education. But when they set those dollars aside, they set some of it aside for public education, and now they set a good amount aside for private education, for private voucher school education. And I think that one of our challenges is that the decision to set aside dollars for private voucher schools really represents a decision to fund two separate school systems in the state of Wisconsin, especially given the fact that about 70% of the students statewide who signed up for the vouchers here over the summer are already in those private voucher schools in some form or another. So it really has become a way to fund those schools, most of them all religious schools. And I think, taking my superintendent's hat off for a moment, one of the things that I'm having a hard time just getting my getting my head around is the notion of what we always used to assume was a pretty strong wall between funding church versus state. And by what's happening is that's just been broken down with us. So the wall's just been rolled over. I think that's one of the things that we're going to see down the road. It'll be interesting to see how that carries out.
Randy Nelson is the superintendent of the La Crosse School District. We talked about the upcoming school year. You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. From the impact of the new private school voucher program on La Crosse public schools to what the new program means for Aquinas Catholic schools, Aquinas is one of 25 new private schools eligible for the first time to accept voucher students as part of the new statewide plan. I talked with Aquinas Catholic Schools President Kurt Nelson in his office about what the change means.
The families that meet the criteria for this program are those that have the most modest of economic means, so paying extra tuition is a challenge for them. Even with lots and lots of scholarship dollars and financial aid that we provide, it still is a huge challenge. So this allows those families to be able to choose, you know, a Catholic school or you know, in our particular area or in other areas, another private school that really meets the needs of, for their child.
How many families will be able to use the voucher program here at Aquinas?
We actually received notice of 22 students that have been selected to receive a voucher. So we're in the process now of those families. There's a final step that they do to accept that voucher and become fully enrolled and everything. So we're in the process of doing those right now. So we have 16 of those confirmed now, and the rest, you know, have to be in the next couple days. So we're about 22 students.
And with school starting this week, it's kind of quick turnaround. And for at least the families, I don't know if they have to change anything or if it's almost like an added bonus for them this year.
It is a very quick turnaround. And we had out of the 22 families, half of those, about 11, were students that were already enrolled for the fall at Aquinas, and 11 were brand new students. So for those brand new families, you're right, it's been a very quick kind of scramble and quick short notice to make those changes. But it's been a really exciting thing. I know the families are tremendously excited and very grateful. Our teachers are very excited because they know the struggles too that the families go through, and so it's been really, really exciting for us. This first year, it's been a very compressed timeline, so that we're right up here against the start of school. In starting the next year, though, the timeline will actually be kind of February to April, right around the time that's the same as the public school open enrollment period. It's during our Aquinas Catholic Schools enrollment period, so it'll be a much more natural timeline next year where people will have lots of notice to be able to make those preparations.
More students will be able to apply for the voucher program next year. Do you have any sense whether or not more students will be able to come to Aquinas through the voucher program, more than that 22 this year for next year?
Well, that actually is one of the things that DPI is clarifying right now with the legislature. They're trying to clarify, in the second year, does it mean they go through the same process and 25 additional schools get in? Or is it the same 25 schools that now get those 1,000 slots instead of 500? So they're still trying to work out exactly the second year. But we know that as one of the first set of 25 schools, we will automatically be eligible next year and be included in the program. So that makes a huge difference for families.
What sort of difference does it make for financial aid? Since I'm assuming you have a set amount of grants and scholarships and payment options, possibly. Mm-hmm. So how does this change financial aid? Can you expand it to more families, since there are families who will be receiving vouchers now?
Yeah, what we're doing right now is looking at the families who did receive a voucher. Some of those families that I mentioned had already enrolled in Aquinas Catholic Schools, so we had already allocated scholarship awards for those families. So we're currently in the process of looking at those families that received a voucher who will not need those scholarship dollars now, and actually being able to reallocate those to other families who qualified for the voucher program but weren't selected as one of the 22. We had 100 students altogether that qualified. So we'll look at those other families who didn't get picked and say, okay, are there some additional scholarship funds we can provide to those families to try to make it within their reach as well?
And are most of these families from La Crosse County, or is there a certain area that they can come from in order to use the voucher program?
They really can come from anywhere. The families that applied for vouchers came primarily from the La Crosse School District boundaries, but we also had students from Holman and Onalaska, West Salem, and DeSoto districts. So most of the students who were selected, most of them were La Crosse, and we had a few West Salem families as well.
If the voucher program continues, what sort of difference do you think it will make overall for families in the area who, you know, would like to have this option to send their children to a Catholic school but haven't been able to financially afford it?
I know that there's a lot of families who are interested in Catholic education, but they kind of know that tuition's right up there. So immediately that throws up a roadblock. And some families don't even investigate it any further than that, because they just go, we can't afford anything else additionally, you know, beyond our taxes and other commitments. There are a lot of other families, though, that do make some sacrifices to start and maybe can do that for a couple of years, but then it gets to be overwhelming, even with additional financial aid. So they only can go through elementary or, you know, for so many years, and then they can't continue. So there's a lot of families that are also in that bind of they want to continue Catholic education, but as it gets a little bit more expensive, as students start getting into high school and things, they want to be able to continue that, and this provides them help with that.
And I know there's a handful of things going on within the state legislature regarding how the voucher school programs will be overseen and whatnot. What are your thoughts on what's going on at the state level when it comes to this?
A lot of the issues that are being thrown around for accountability are measures that Aquinas Catholic Schools already meets, things like qualifications for staff and things. While that wasn't included in the original legislation expanding the program, one of the requirements of that legislation was you have to be accredited. And accreditation requires that we have certified teachers. So while the legislature didn't directly require it, in essence, we are required to have it because we have to be accredited and meet all those criteria. So there are a number of things that, you know, almost all of those criteria that they're talking about Aquinas Catholic Schools is already doing. And so it isn't as big of an issue for us, I know.
And what about the people who say there should be this separation of church and state? They don't want their state dollars going towards a religious education. And it's not just, you know, there's plenty of Catholic schools, Lutheran schools, there were Jewish schools that were approved for the voucher program. But how do you respond to that?
Well, I think the biggest issue is to remember that the state has a very legitimate interest in making sure its citizens are well-educated. That nobody doubts. But I think one of the things that we've realized, too, is that doesn't just mean only state government schools can do that. It really is about giving parents choices, and if parents decide that a different type of school meets their needs best, whether it's a public school, a charter school, an online school, or a private school, allow parents to make those choices, and then the tax dollars that are meant to educate that child should follow that child to provide the education for that child. That's ultimately the goal, is to educate each individual child, not just to maintain a school system, per se.
Kurt Nelson is president of Aquinas Catholic Schools in La Crosse. He talked about the start of the statewide private school voucher program in its first year at Aquinas. Aquinas was one of 25 new private schools accepted into the program by the state of Wisconsin for the school year. You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. Coming up next, we'll talk about the La Crosse Compassion Project. More than 6,000 La Crosse students will be sharing their views on compassion through art and writing. Archives of this and other recent editions of Newsmakers, extended interviews, photos, and links can be found on our website at wpr.org/lacrosse. You can also like us on Facebook at WPR Newsmakers. From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, this is Newsmakers. I'm Maureen McCollum. Children in La Crosse schools are participating in an ambitious district-wide art project this year. Students are being asked to share their perspective on what it means to be compassionate. I talked about the Compassion Project with La Crosse Education Foundation Executive Director Tim Riley and La Crosse School Superintendent Randy Nelson.
You know, compassion is one of our core values. We have 7 core values in our district, compassion being one of those core values. And it's something that we teach in schools. We have a written curriculum to support that. When Tim Riley, our new executive director of the La Crosse Public Education Foundation, came on board, just one of the past experiences he's had, it was to be involved in a compassion project in a prior community. And so it was very intriguing because it allowed us an opportunity to bring a whole community focus to compassion and not just in our classrooms. I really believe as superintendent that our students, our schools reflect our classrooms and our community, and our community is reflected in our classrooms and our schools. And it's really critical that our students 24/7 experience and are being modeled what compassion means in our community. And I think too many times, after school hours, sometimes during school hours, when students don't speak to each other the right way, or ways that are dignified, but too many times our students are seeing behaviors modeled by adults. Actually, more by adults. I mean, these kinds of behaviors that we're trying to really work on are things that are modeled by adults. Kids see them, and they see them a lot more outside of our schools than they see them inside of our schools, whether it's our legislators sometimes in the way that they talk to each other and the bickering goes on, or even a lot of the TV programs that our students are being allowed to see these days. They've changed over the years, and some of the very premises on those programs are not compassionate at all. It really is about, you know, cutting one another down. And so this seemed like a wonderful opportunity for the district to really tap into some of the expertise and past experiences of our executive director of the Public Education Foundation and create an opportunity to try to bring together not just a school district focus, but a community focus on compassion.
And Tim, can you explain the specifics of this art project, the Compassion Project within the district?
The premise is simple. We're asking every child in the district who takes an art class, of course, in the primary grades, it's everyone, in middle school and high school, it's an elective, to contemplate and ask the question, how would you depict the concept of compassion on a 6-inch by 6-inch canvas? Everyone can draw a cat or a dog or a fish or their face. I can't do it very well, but I could do it if asked. But to imagine the concept of compassion and the dictionary definition of compassion is to recognize the suffering in someone and having the need or the desire to alleviate that suffering. And when you think about that and you are asked to depict that and then write about it. We're asking each student to write a few sentences about their work. It gets you thinking about compassion. It's one of the core values in the school district. And I think, you know, that act of thinking about compassion, slowing down in this world that seems to be whizzing by with all the social media and television programs and so forth, to pause and reflect on what it is to be kind to one another, and alleviate suffering in this world is, I think, a good exercise. And, of course, that happens one-on-one with the art teacher and the student. But then it's magnified 6,000 times when you take all of these canvases together. They'll be exhibited at the Pump House in the spring of 2014. Every square inch of the walls in the galleries there will be filled with these images of compassion. I like to think of it as a grand mosaic of compassion. And everyone's going to be different. Every child's going to have a different story. Some will be humorous, I'm sure. Some will be quite poignant. It's a really great chance for us to learn about compassion from our youngest citizens of the community.
And you worked on this previously in the Appleton School District. Can you talk about that experience and maybe what inspired you to start it there?
We had all of the school district and some of the private schools in the Fox Cities participate in a project like this. And the genesis really came, believe it or not from an art emphasis necessarily, but from a neuroscientist in Madison named Richard Davidson. And Richard Davidson is the director of the Center for Investigating Healthy Minds at the Weissman Center at UW-Madison. And he is a neuroscientist using some of the cutting-edge technology and brain scans and so forth. And his research has shown that those who think about or act or even meditate upon compassion have measurably healthier brains. I mean, he's the kind of guy who will take you and put you in an MRI scanner and see a 3D image of your brain, the parts that light up when you're happy. And those who think about or meditate or contemplate compassion or act compassionately, the positive aspects of their brain just light up. So when I heard about Davidson's research and got to speak with Richard Davidson, he kind of inspired us to think about how that might translate into the art world, because the art making process is in a way, you know, a reflection, almost a meditation on this concept of compassion. So the thesis here is that those who make artwork on compassion will have measurably healthier brains. So it's a great education experience.
And Randy Nelson, how do you think that a project like this will translate to other areas of the classroom beyond sitting at the desk, sitting at a table and painting or drawing?
Well, it should be something that I believe permeates our schools. It should be something that, you know, in as much as this is something we continually work on with kids, how do you treat one another? How do you, you never really understand someone until you've stepped in their shoes, a little bit kind of approach. You know, our real intent is to create a school-wide approach, a school-wide awareness, a school-wide practice in each one of our buildings about compassion. What does it mean to be compassionate? And it's more important, obviously, than it's more than just about talking about the definition and talking about what it means. Still, the next level is to actually practice it. And so we want to make sure that we're providing opportunities for our students not just to hear about it and be aware about it, but also to know what it looks like, to practice that. And we really believe that at the end of the day, as we become more aware of each other, more compassionate with one another, one of our bottom lines that we have in education is to improve our results. And I really believe that that's a fundamental piece in terms of improving our results. When kids aren't feeling as though they're coming into a compassionate learning situation, then it's really difficult. You can try a lot of different strategies, but I think until you can eclipse that, until you can overcome that particular piece, it can really become a struggle along the way.
Are there other ways, other concrete ways that the idea of compassion is going to be integrated into other areas of studies?
Well, you know, we do have, especially at elementary, we have a written curriculum regarding compassion as well as our other core values. And so we really do provide some direct instruction with regard, again, to what that is and what it looks like. And I do think that one of the things we're going to be working on now, especially with our art teachers, is, okay, if I'm going to participate in helping students using class time to create these compassionate depictions that they have, then how what are the lessons that I can do to help lead up to that, to help them understand, to help them think about, to help them take on this action? You know, I think that that as opposed to saying here's a curriculum that needs to happen in every single classroom in grade 7 and every classroom in grade 8. We do have our core values. Compassion is embedded in those core values. And what I'm really encouraging our staff to do is to pick up on it and bring some extra discussion to it, additional discussion to it, and really work on watch the behaviors of our students to ensure that, indeed, compassion is not just something we talk about, but it's something that we practice and we recognize it when it does happen in our schools.
You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. My guests today are La Crosse School District Superintendent Randy Nelson and La Crosse Public Education Foundation Executive Director Tim Riley. We're talking about the Compassion Project. It seems like society over the last couple of years has really tried to address the bullying issue. How much of the Compassion Project has to do with really combating bullying?
I certainly think that's part of it, but I would have to say really that we really aren't hooking our wagon to the Compassion Project because we believe that we have a severe bullying problem. Bullying happens. Bullying happens in schools. It happens between kids in schools. And so is it something that we're doing to address that directly? No. This is something about something that really transcends just who we are and why we are and how we exist and how we work with one another, how we understand one another, that really needs to go well beyond the classroom walls and into our community and actually even larger than that. And so the idea is compassion starts here, and let's get it rolling. Let's be cognizant. Let's be aware of one another and how we treat each other. Let's make sure we know someone before we're really understanding, you know, who they are and where they come from. Let's walk a mile in the shoes before we really know those things. So it's really about something that transcends this piece. And I think it really begins in homes. And our schools are going to extend that with their work this year and in coming years on compassion. This is not just a one-year thing. You know, there's a beginning and an end to this. This is something that we really hope that over the next several years will become a fixture in our community discussions.
And, Tim, has this continued in Appleton? And have they maybe noticed a difference over the years with the project?
The Appleton Compassion Project was done in 2010 and 11. And through the efforts of the school district there and that community, I know that the city of Appleton, the common council there, embraced the idea. Appleton was declared one of the compassionate cities by the International Campaign for Compassionate Cities. And I know La Crosse is on the candidate list now, which is exciting. And yes, it has impacted more than just the school children and their parents and their families and their aunts and uncles. It's becoming ingrained in the community. Other colleges and universities in the Fox Cities, for instance, became involved. A sculpture class at Lawrence University in Appleton did Compassion Project manhole covers. So those are going to be in the sidewalks for 150 years, thanks to Nina Foundry. So it's a snowball effect. It's getting bigger and bigger. And the same thing's happening here in La Crosse already, which is very exciting.
Sometimes you hear younger children now referred to as the me generation. Is this a time more than ever that younger children need to be taught about compassion?
There's something to be said for that. And I think one of our challenges as a society and, of course, then in education is that, you know, these the generational studies that have occurred over the last, you know, two or three decades as you start to describe generations of individuals, the studies are really showing that those generations are shorter and shorter and shorter. It used to be that, you know, one generation might be decades of individuals, and now sometimes it's down to months. And who knows where that's going to go. But I think this is an important part of addressing these short snippets of generational pieces, whether it's me or whether it's X or Y generations or whatever they are. I think this is really an important part about helping our children and our community understand our baseline is that we're all here and we're all human and we share the same place. And so that should be the basis for everything that we do. And no matter what generation it is, including a kind of a me generation, I think it's an important part of helping our children understand what really glues us together.
Tim, did you want to add anything?
I think that, you know, compassion has been around for millennia. There have been countless civilizations, faith-based traditions who have touted compassion and the golden rule, do unto others as you would like to have someone do unto you. I think that, that's, been around for a long time for a reason. As Randy indicated, we're in this together, and compassion really forces you, contemplating compassion, to think about others and to want to help others, and that's exactly what this project does, and in a profound way, on a number of levels, on the artistic level, on a conversation level, at the dinner table, at recess. It's going to be an exciting project for all of us.
Let's talk about bringing it to the dinner table. You want to involve families. You want to make this about more about community, not necessarily about an art project that the
Correct.
Students work on. Mm-hmm. How do you hope that families talk about a project like this? And maybe what sort of transformation do you hope to see around the dinner table, maybe as a result of the Compassion Project?
First, I do hope that they do talk. I think one of our challenges these days is that we have children and parents and the siblings of children who are so busy with activities and things going on that even having the capacity to sit down and have a conversation about anything can be a challenge. But with regard to having a conversation about compassion, really it's a hope that indeed will happen, that our parents will have an opportunity to take some time and make sure, whether it's at supper or in some other venue with family, that they have discussions about that they are creating their own awareness of what's important for the children, but also what's important for all of us. That being said, we're not poised to create a home curriculum necessarily. I think we'll have resources and things that people will be able to use, but I think what can be most powerful about this from our community perspective is that we don't have a prescription for the conversation, because it's less about having a curriculum and a prescription and more about just a way of being. And some of that way of being is just inherent in all of us. Tim has shared with me such compelling data from Dr. Davidson, who will be in our community here next June, just about how really the assumption is that we're just born with a degree of compassion that just resides in us. And so the idea here in 2013 and beyond is to talk about that. And I think that there could be more power by this growing organically than by trying to create something that people are supposed to use. For instance, I don't think it really can have the same impact then, because this is about the way we are and not so much about having something that's prescriptive.
You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCullum. My guests today are Randy Nelson. He's the La Crosse School District Superintendent. And Tim Riley. He's the La Crosse Public Education Foundation Executive Director. We're talking about the Compassion Project. Is there anything else the two of you would like to talk about in regards to the Compassion Project?
It's going to take forms that we can't even imagine right now. As the students and teachers begin to work on the art-making phase of the project in the fall, when classes resume at all the schools, we're going to see students, for instance, think about compassion in terms of the environment. The earth is suffering. Let's do something about it. Some of the units that I think may naturally evolve organically through the project will be, revolve around Earth Day and how can we show compassion towards our environment and towards the Earth. Other students may, in fact, look at compassion in the family, animal rights. This can really we can use compassion in a dialogue with a lot of different disciplines that span not only art, but science, humanities, even mathematics. You can make the argument that there can be compassionate math, and some of the students will do that, saying I showed compassion by helping my friend do their homework, that kind of thing, and there are going to be 6,000 different stories of compassion, and it's going to be exciting to see.
The fact that the Pump House is going to be filled with 6,000 works of art, that's incredibly moving.
I can't wait for that to happen. And actually, I hope that that's the beginning. In as much as our teachers are going to be starting really soon on this project here in the fall when school begins, this public display of this artwork, I hope, is more of a beginning of further discussions more than it is a culmination. If it's a culmination, then I know that we will not have done this well as a community. We really want it to be something that our business community picks up on now. We'd like to perhaps make some of the pieces of artwork available to our business community so that they can, we've talked to people who are supporting this, this forest. Is there a way that we can take these 6-inch by 6-inch panels and blow them up? Can we enlarge them so that they might be available to be widely distributed in our community and that they could be in the front windows of businesses in our community? So that those students have access, and we have this piece out there where it's ever present. So the idea is that after we do this piece at the pump house next spring and summer, that really begins these discussions. I wanted to also mention further comment on what Tim said earlier. We expect to learn from kids in this. And I think what's really going to be powerful about this is, for those of us who have children or raised children, there are times when you, as an adult, hear the most profound things come out of the mouth of your child, whether you're having a discussion about them. And sometimes they have a way to just bring it right down to brass tacks. And you go, okay, I hadn't thought of it that way. Boy, that's really – and I think that one of the neat things about this project is that we're going to see that over and over again, not just in looking at how that child depicted compassion on that 6-inch by 6-inch canvas, but also we'll be able to have a little bit of a discussion about what they wrote about. I wrote this, or I painted this, or I put this because this is about my dad, or this is about our pet, or this is about something else. Because, it's one thing sometimes to look at the artwork and say, okay, I'm not so sure that I'm understanding that, but it's fully another to be able to read what the actual artist was intending to do with that and what those pieces really mean. And I think that's just going to so richly fill in blanks. And I think as adults, we're going to learn so much from our young people in our community. I'm really excited about it.
There's another component to the Compassion Project that should be said, and that we're going to digitize all these images. We're taking high-definition photographs of every single work of art, and we're going to make those statements available, and there's going to be a website and some mobile apps so that Grandma in Topeka can actually look at these as well. So the audience will be truly a worldwide audience, not just those who visit the gallery at the pump house. In fact, the technology aspect of it is an important one because, with every square inch of the pump house wall being taken with these artworks, in order to read those statements, you need to use technology to make sure that people can read what the works are about. So that's an important part of it.
Could be kind of interesting, too, because maybe many of those students have never been to an art gallery before. And that could be transformative as well.
An important experience, as a matter of fact, when you look at some of the literature and some of the literature that you read about students who, for whatever reason, find themselves behind, or you look at students who come from difficult financial circumstances, the issue is not that those students are unable to learn. The issue is usually that they're coming to school with some unfilled opportunities that other students have had in the classroom, whether it's a visit to a museum or whether it's some other event. And so I think you really hit on an important piece here, that the students are going to have this opportunity to fill this as one of their gaps if they haven't had an opportunity in an art museum someplace. So I think it's going to be a critical part of this.
Tim, you talked about how you're going to be digitizing these works of art, placing them online, and I know throughout the year, too, you want to have other events around the Compassion Project. I understand there's going to be some celebrity outreach. Do you want to talk about some of the other efforts going on throughout the year regarding the Compassion Project?
The exhibition will be at the Pump House from May 2nd until June 28th of 2014. We know that Richard Davidson from Madison, has graciously agreed to come and give a public presentation here in La Crosse on June 2nd of 2014. That's exciting. We're currently talking about doing some concerts, maybe some theatrical performances, some other writing exercises, organizations, other nonprofits, businesses, schools and universities in the community are very eager to raise the awareness of compassion in the entire community. So, there are a lot of things that are going to be happening. Some we don't know about right now. It'll be an organic process as things move forward, but that's what's exciting about it.
I have to ask you before we wrap up, if you were to create your own 6x6 Compassion Project tile right now, what is it that you think you would create? Randy?
The first thing that I think about are are all of those individuals, all of those people who are fighting for our country overseas or wherever they are, and they're wearing that military uniform. And that compassion that we all must have, politics aside, but the compassion we all must have for individuals who have sacrificed themselves, sacrificed their families, being with their families, and so many other things, so that they can fight for our country and for our freedoms. There would be I would depict something like that. I think that's such an important part. And actually, it's one of the reasons that we're here and we're able to talk about compassion and we're able to talk about putting 6,000 pieces of artwork in that pump house.
And Tim, what about you?
I've seen a lot of these images. Actually done one already.
What was the one that you completed?
It was kind of an abstract work with multiple layers and showing that compassion is deep within us. Though I would consider putting a mirror on a 6-inch by 6-inch canvas such that everyone who encounters the work of art sees themselves and realize that compassion begins with you. I think that would be a compelling statement.
Tim Riley is the executive director of the La Crosse Education Foundation, and Randy Nelson is superintendent of the La Crosse School District. They spoke about the La Crosse Compassion Project, an art project that more than 6,000 students will participate in during the next school year. Thanks for listening to Newsmakers. From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, I'm Maureen McCullum. Our production team includes John Gatto, Mary Meehan Strube, and our senior producer, John Davis. To hear archives of this or other recent editions of Newsmakers, visit our website at wpr.org/lacrosse. You'll also find extended interviews, photos, and a link to the Compassion Project. And if you'd like to comment on our program or have a suggestion for future shows, you'll also find links to our producers and staff. That and more at wpr.org/lacrosse. You can also find Newsmakers on Facebook, updates on future shows, links to our archives, and more. Like us on Facebook at WPR Newsmakers.